What is the best approach to starting a novel deep tech life science company? In this episode, I'm talking with Samantha Dale-Strasser, CSO and co-founder of Pepper Bio, about her academic career at the University of Cambridge and MIT, and the process of starting her company, Pepper Bio.
The excitement for the future that's to come, in that we've seen over time this bringing of new data and information through genomics, through transcriptomics of the last 10, 20 years. And I am ecstatic to be at a time where it's inevitable that we'll see bringing new technologies to bear of larger data sets and data collection in biology. I think it's a phenomenal time to be in the field and excited to be leading the charge and bringing functional data such as fossil proteomics to play to really reach that goal of treating the untreatable. So excited to share the story today. Thanks, too, for a great chat.
Backed by VC firm NFX, Pepper Bio uses proprietary lab methods and computational abilities to unlock a new level of sophistication in drug discovery. Called the Google Maps for Drug Discovery, Pepper Bio helps partners find the safest and fastest route to new effective drugs in clinical trials by analyzing transomics data. So far, the company has already identified applications of its technology for rare diseases in oncology, neurology, and inflammatory. Samantha co-founded Pepper Bio based upon foundational work she pioneered during her PhD studies at MIT. Her development of the first transomic machine learning platform is revolutionizing how we discover drugs and treat diseases. This approach has already identified and validated previously unseen insights in inflammatory diseases and undruggable cancers. She paved the way to Pepper's first commercial partner, eager to apply this approach to central nervous system diseases. In this episode, we are talking about the ecosystem in Boston, the importance of aligning vision, mission, goals and actions, challenges in drug discovery, fundraising strategy for the United States, the story behind Pepper Bio, and much, much more. Enjoy the show. Samantha, it's awesome to see you again. How are you doing today?
Doing well. Finally making it past the heat wave here in Boston. So pretty happy about that. Hopefully getting some storms today. So.
You also have a heat wave in Boston. It's similar.
Yes, it seems like it's been a wonderfully worldwide phenomenon. We've all been sharing experiences thereof.
It's pretty much the same situation in the United States and in Europe. I like the background. Are the pictures yours? Did you paint them?
Ah, thank you. I did, in fact. In my free time, when I have it, which is rare and few and far between, but I always love relaxing with something that I can physically do with my hands, and painting's been a fun outlet for that for me. So thank you.
What are the paintings about?
So they're actually all clouds and images that I've seen just through trips I've taken or the like. I've always really liked their kind of allowing me to study more color and light as opposed to form. And so I can really focus on those first two in doing so.
Are there many clouds currently in the day sky in Boston?
Today, actually, no. Okay. We are very bright, blue, sunny skies here in Boston. But we have a huge range of different clouds that come through with storms, which is always pretty fun. So,
the last time that I was in Boston was in 2018. It was the Bio International. I think it was 2018. 2019 was in Philadelphia. And I hope that next year I can come back to Boston. What would you recommend me to visit when I'm in Boston as a tourist?
Oh, well, there's so many things. One thing that I've always really loved, the paintings behind me will kind of make sense for this, but the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum is absolutely beautiful, a really unique setup for a museum. It's an old mansion that Isabella had kind of curated everything herself, and the artwork itself is actually located where she curated it to be. So it's unique from traditional museums in that sense, so...
I will put it on my list for next year.
Excellent. Look forward to hearing what you think.
Oh, I will tell you. I will tell you. But it's I think it's 8-9 months next year in June should be in Boston.
Okay. So we'll good take time. Some time. Hopefully before any heat waves next year.
I hope so too. But meanwhile, I'm I think experienced with heat waves also here in Central Europe.
Yes.
Samantha, let me ask you the first questions in our conversation about your academic background. Can you describe it a little bit to me?
Absolutely. So first, just by way of big picture context, I've always been really excited about finally the data that we have access to in biology, coupled with computational tools and empowered to do something with that. And so I've really structured my academic background around these two pillars that I sometimes call a bilingual engineering background. And so for me, that actually started at Northwestern University, just outside Chicago, not too far from my home state of Wisconsin. And while there, I studied biomedical engineering and applied mathematics. So really, again, that duality of biological with computational. And while I was there was actually where I met my co-founder for Pepper. So when we chat more about Pepper, kind of our context in many ways goes back over 10 years now. So it's been exciting to really have that kind of established, you know, connection with someone about working and really bringing a change in the world. Following Northwestern, I went to actually Europe for about a year. I went to the University of Cambridge as a Churchill scholar. So I was in Churchill College while I was there. And following my time there, I came back to the US for my PhD. So it was while starting my PhD at MIT, again, kind of in this bilingual space of earning my degree in electrical engineering and computer science, so on the computational side, while doing research in Doug Laufenberger's group in biological engineering, that I really started to delve after a lot of the questions that built the foundation for Pepper's technology to date that we've now been building and expanding upon. So it's been, a phenomenal collection of individuals and network that I've kind of been able to grow throughout and kind of bring us to where we're building Pepper today.
That's great. MIT is also on your list. And there are two stories from the MIT. One real person from the MIT. And one is in a series. It was in The Big Bang Theory, where Sheldon Cooper always joked around about the MIT and that it's not a real university. So in his opinion, it was a comedy series, of course. And there is this famous podcaster, Lex Fridman, who I think is also or was a lecturer at the MIT. What I always was curious about, how is life at the MIT in reality?
What I really loved about it is it's a really driven community. So it's a group of people who are really focused on making change in the world. And I think, you know, there's that perspective of the MIT hacker, the MIT builder is kind of what often folks might think of. And I was excited to see that thread in a really positive light exist. I mean, there's an amazing amount of resources for students, be it undergraduate, graduate students, and a real focus on trying something new to make a difference. That's a bubble that I've felt really fortunate to be a part of and really think it's phenomenal what the community has cultivated in that sense.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
You love listening to podcasts, but have you ever thought about starting your own podcast? Maybe you want to build a brand, grow your business, or are looking for an excuse to talk about your favorite hobby. Whatever your reason for making a podcast, Buzzsprout is the place to start. Since 2009, Buzzsprout has helped over 300,000 people launch their own podcasts. Buzzsprout walks you step by step through the whole process and will give you powerful tools to start, grow, and monetize your podcast. Ready to get started? Click the link in the show notes to get our free step-by-step guide to starting your podcast today.
And what stands out at the MIT when we think about entrepreneurship?
So I think every person's experience is really bespoke. So for me, what stood out was just the resources of people who are willing to talk to you and answer questions. So throughout my graduate career in the EECS department, as well as throughout the Institute, there were folks who were really listening to, okay, what do students want? What do they need? What are questions? And they really quickly adapted to serving those requests. And so a lot of that in entrepreneurship meant a program that actually we started while I was a graduate student that's now called Start MIT, was historically called Start 6, coming out of electrical engineering and computer science. but was started by Anantha Chandrakasan and was a really phenomenal resource that we grew real time in many ways of to listening to what students needed and to meet that entrepreneurial goal of bringing together alumni, bringing together resources to help people learn what patterns there are to best, you know, really make a change in that space quickly.
I was smiling when you were talking because it reminded me of my university career in the 90s. And you said that the MIT serves the students' needs. And a story popped up in my mind about the exams back in the 90s. And the interesting thing was that the failure rate at the university was pretty high. It was up to 90% at each exam. And the funny thing was the teachers were really proud of it. So that 90% of students failed. And now you contrast it with stories from the MIT and say, this institution is there to serve the students. How is the service for students at the MIT?
It's been phenomenal from my experience. I mean, I think it's funny you mentioned that the exam and the failure rate. I mean, it is very intense. I think that's something that, you know, every student can attest to. There's often the analogy of it being like a fire hose of just information and of new things to keep understanding and learning and coming at you, which as you know, Ken is definitely something to adapt to, but I've found really that perspective in terms of serving students helps to cultivate a community that thinks very quickly and thinks very astutely about challenges. I think there's, you know, it's a double-edged sword for sure in terms of the intensity, because it is a lot, but I think that's ultimately been serving students for the realm of bringing in challenges that can then help them learn how to overcome and think through that for future things that they do in their career.
What's the failure rate at the MIT? So once people are in?
It's a good question. Honestly, I don't know. I don't have numbers on that. I've not looked. So for me as a graduate student, I think it's always a different lens versus say an undergraduate perspective, because there's just a very different community in that sense around how classes are taken, how research is looked at. See, my course load was very different than an undergraduate student would be. I don't know the failure rate to speak to in terms of numerical numbers.
Yeah, I believe both in Europe and in the United States, a lot changed to the better in the last three decades. And think at all universities. We can now test if I did my research right and if I listened properly so far. You lived two times in Cambridge, so one time in the United States and one time in the United Kingdom. What I'm curious about is what are the differences between these two cities from your perspective?
It's similar and different in many ways. So, I mean, as a whole, both had a phenomenal community of people. I mean, I think that's a common thread I've found wherever I live, that's really what makes the core of a location. And for me, my experiences there both had people who were very active and driven about what they were excited to do in terms of their career, the science, and elsewise in the humanities for each for sure. Differences, I personally think the UK Cambridge architecturally is more striking, but I just partly myself love older architecture. So that's a kind of personal bias.
The UK, we love you for that.
Oh, yes. It was phenomenal. Kind of for me, a childhood dream in many ways of just wanting to go visit. And I was not disappointed. So very much enjoyed that experience.
How long was your stay in Cambridge in the United Kingdom?
Not long. It was about 10 months. So I was there for a master's degree while I was in the UK, but made, you know, in that time, the most of it, both academically from just the labs and people I got to know. The college experience itself at Cambridge is very distinct. And my friends can attest to, we traveled a lot while we were there. So in that sense, was also a really great opportunity across the board in terms of the experience there.
Did you travel only in the United Kingdom or did you also visit?
No, I actually made it over to Vienna for part of my travels. Yes. I spent actually Christmas in Vienna, which was phenomenal. But no, we went to Vienna, to Oslo in Norway, to a couple of places in Italy, Florence and Barga. So no, we had a great chance to see other cultures and communities while we were there, for sure.
The most beautiful places from Europe, I guess.
Well, I think, you know, across the board, there's many, it's hard to pick. So it was definitely a phenomenal time.
And when we switched to the United States, how is life in Cambridge in the United States?
It's actually funny. Every time I leave, I remember the distinctions that make Cambridge and in the US really unique, which a lot of it is just you have a really high density of students and of people who are at universities, which is definitely makes, you know, you can go to a coffee shop and hear people talking about their research in, you know, fusion energy. You can go to, you know, just down the street and you'll hear folks that are, say, from, you know, say the Broad Institute or one of the universities nearby of just working on, you know, large genetics projects. So you have a wide range of really technical people around that is, you know, I think really what makes the community distinct. You know, you can walk down the street and see Moderna, you can see Pfizer, you can see just a wealth of really proximal, really phenomenal companies and industries to be a part of.
That sounds really awesome. That sounds really great. When I was a student in the 90s, so the usual career was you get a degree and then you have one choice. Either you go into the industry, you work in the industry, or you pursue an academic career. So it's a standard, I think, PhD and afterward becoming a teacher at the university, and that's it for the rest of your life. Anything in the 90s, you know, I mean, it was in Austria, it was Graz, it was a very small city. Also, a lot of students in the city, and it was very lively and it was fun being there. But founding companies back in the 90s was not the go-to choice for students. So it's mostly in Austria, it was people in their 50s who had a career in the industry. And then at the end of the career, founded a company, a consultancy or something else, served the industry, mm-hmm. and then retired. What was your motivation in the United States to start a company practically right after graduating?
Yeah. For me, a lot stemmed from the impact that I wanted to make and where I saw most effective for that impact to be made quickly. I've always been really focused on, you know, bringing things to bear that make experiences on our planet better. That's been a driving force for me across the board of thinking about what I want to do in my career. And from the research that I was doing in graduate school, and my goal to make an impact for patients within healthcare, I saw the quickest way to do that and to really have the ability to grow that the way that I saw could effectively bring it to bear was through a startup. I think there's, you know, really depends on the research questions and the science, but for me, of taking a really fundamental goal of improving how we make decisions in drug discovery, I saw doing that through a startup as the quickest way to do that. For me, I had considered staying in, you know, in more research through academia and the like. I found that the questions and the translation ability would have been a different fraction. It had been more focused on research as opposed to focused here, where I'm really focused on bringing that to bear in terms of to market. And for me, that bringing to market and bringing to application very quickly was the part that drove me to seeing a startup was an easy choice in that sense. Obviously, there's, you know, similarities that I think are interesting. You know, some people say as a PI, you're kind of running your own mini company in your lab, which is true, right? You write grants, you get funding, you hire students, just like we hire employees.
It's like a startup.
But yeah, it's something that for me, the translation part to industry, we've been bringing that to folks was much quicker through a startup.
Yeah, that's true. I think the lab work at research institutions is still more scientific driven than market driven. Before we talk about your company, let's say a little bit about this in the startup ecosystem. I tried my first attempt in founding a startup in the 90s. It was something similar to Facebook, but the technology was not that far advanced. And it was more a local solution because the internet was not so well connected like it was 2006 or like it is now. the reactions I got from the environment were quite funny, because I think 100% of the people thought simply me and my friends are nuts. It's simply crazy to start a company in the internet that nobody needs actually. And it must be a failure right away. So the support for startups back then was practically, I would say, very, very close to zero. Maybe offend one or the other person, but it is definitely not... definitely has not been the ecosystem that we see right now here also in Europe. What I'm curious about is how is the situation for scientific startups in Boston and in Cambridge?
It's, I mean, what we found, I mean, obviously that's through a lens of a, you know, drug discovery biotech company. We've found that it's, you know, very strong. You can find networking events probably every day of the week if you really wanted to, in terms of folks ready to chat about and who are intrigued to see what you're building, what you're doing. And this does extend beyond biotech. There's a lot of resources for also alternative energies. Folks may know the name Greentown Labs is local to here. So there's a wealth of both resources in terms of mentors, in terms of potential, you know, folks who are excited to join startups. I think that's something that we found really exciting, is just the community of people. And with universities, I mean, I talked a bit about at MIT, the resources that we have available, but there's, you know, also at Harvard, a, you know, life science lab there as well, that helps to really grow and build startups. With business school, you have a resource of, again, kind of a, you know, business background of folks that are really focused on that. So it's really dense in that sense of just what's available. And I've been, I think, you know, really, I've been to look back and sometimes remember how wonderful that bubble is. And I think as much as folks can find a way to get to know people connected to, it's a very open bubble in that sense that, you know, there's a lot of people excited to chat and we all want to make a difference. And finding passionate people is, yeah, something that across the board here, folks are very excited about.
The ecosystems around Stanford and also in Boston are well known here in Europe. Mm-hmm. And many people dream of the abundance of capital in the United States. Yeah. When I look at the ecosystem in Boston, from your perspective, when you can only choose three success factors, mm-hmm, for Boston, that makes Boston stand out globally, what are the three major key success factors of the ecosystem in Boston?
Three. It's always hard to have
only three
number,
only
but no. I mean, highlighting three that I think are really critical. I mean, one, I've talked a lot about, even in our conversation thus far, people, right? And I think that's a key facet, is just the density of people who are available for mentorship, the density of experienced people who have either started companies on themselves or people who have worked within the industry for years that can provide context of how to get things done. As a company with, you know, nominally younger founders in the field, we found that resource of mentors who are very senior in drug discovery to be phenomenal. The second facet, I guess I'd mentioned, kind of building on the people facet, is just the really high density of world-renowned universities. That's, you know, again, comes back to, you know, the research that's happening there, the momentum, the excitement, the students that are there. So kind of circling a little bit back to my first point of people, but that as well obviously gives a really unique ecosystem to exist. And I think even for Stanford and in the West Coast, that's something that exists there as well. And then I guess the third that I'd highlight would be the hospitals and the surrounding research with that infrastructure. This is obviously distinct to the life science biotech space in particular, but you have, you know, MGH, you have Harvard Medical School, all within walking distance of each other. And that density, and again, that drive and the people connected there, is a really phenomenal ecosystem to be a part of. And I think really makes Boston stand out. See, that kind of that collective of three is really a magnet for many other things as well. So that's where you have other companies coming then as a result of that, based their R&D here. So it feeds itself in a really positive feedback loop over time.
Yeah, that's true. The third factor, hospitals, I never think about it. I think the area is very densely populated around Boston. So there are a lot of people, high population, which helps in clinical trials, I guess.
Exactly. Yeah. Absolutely. I always kind of laugh. We're normally a small city as far as, you know, I think if you're bigger New York's and LA's and the like, but I think within just the density of what we have is it really puts us on the map is just the resources and people are phenomenal.
And I think New York is not far away, isn't it?
No, it's not. And definitely much bigger than Boston.
That's true. When I fly to Boston, it's mostly 3 or 4 days or 5 days. And let's assume that I decide to stay longer, so 2 or 3 days, to connect to the ecosystem that you described in Boston. What would be a good starting point for someone who comes from Europe, who represents a company and decides to, evaluate if it makes sense to found a subsidiary in Boston and connect to the local community? What is the best starting point?
I guess I would highlight two things. So one, and this goes for even Boston or elsewhere, if there's a conference that's available that offers one-on-one networking that really provides an infrastructure to effectively meet with folks, we found that highly effective at getting to know companies in Boston and elsewhere. I think that's something, it's essentially speed dating for meeting companies at conferences. And it's very fast, very rapid fire, but it gives a really quick connection that we found is more directed than, say, networking in a more free form in that sense. So you know a bit more what you're expecting coming in. And I think folks also like that on the other side of the table, knowing what to expect. The second facet, if it's Boston specific, would also be to, you know, plan ahead and really reach out to folks. So if there's specific labs that you're interested in, or if there's specific companies that you're interested in, startups, for example, to reach out and just, you know, say, hey, I'll be in the area, would love to grab coffee. I think people are always really excited about that personal connection, especially after, you know, seeing throughout the pandemic how much being in person can add significant, you know, value when you're first getting to know someone. So I think even that level can be really effective at talking with folks. Once you get to know folks, it's usually also, you know, you can use that as a springboard to see if they know other individuals who would be highly relevant to your interests. And that can just from that really snowball in many ways of just people and connections as a result of that.
I agree to what you say. I think the most important part in business life are personal relationships, and it needs real life. So when someone wants to do something in the United States, founding an office or opening an office is, I think, mandatory. And it doesn't work via Zoom 100% of the time.
Or at least taking many trips. I think even if it's, you know, opening an office is hard, I think, you know, as much as you can visit in person can definitely help to get boots on the ground, even if intermittently, because I think that, you know, for folks here, you just get a different, to your point of, you know, and agreeing, a different connection and ability to get to know people and have them feel comfortable in terms of expanding their network to you as well.
Would have agreed to what you say up to 2020, but currently I think still the travel industry is not where it was used to be in the 20s. I always see, I mean, experienced myself when I traveled to San Diego, I got a weekend extra because I couldn't get a trip back. So taking many trips can be adventurous these days.
That is true. That is absolutely true. I actually, similarly, some folks on our end and for bio in San Diego, which I'm assuming was why you were there, was the same experience that they had as well.
How was your experience flying from Boston to San Diego?
I frankly got lucky in my trip and didn't have the delays, but I know that was a rarity. So I guess that to that point for folks, I think another avenue, if it's really looking for getting kind of connections more closely, obviously you can have an office here or have, you know, establish, you know, hire individuals who are remote based in Boston, but can still meet folks in person. I think that's another kind of interesting way, acknowledging the travel challenges and still have a balance of being in person as associated with the company. But any event, it's definitely curious times for travel for sure.
yeah, probably hit the jackpot because on my way to San Diego, everything went very well up to Chicago. And then a connecting flight was from Chicago to San Diego.
Okay.
But we had a lightning struck in the airplane midway. So we had an emergency landing in Denver.
Oh, wow. I've never had that experience. That sounds like an adventure.
I slept through. I was sleeping. So I just got a little bit of information after landing. So that it was an emergency landing and people were really scared and frightened. Then we had, I think we had to wait about 4 or 5 hours for the next airplane. And when the airplane was about to take off, the pilot said that his shift was over, so he has to return to the airport. And we had to wait another 2 hours for the next plane. So it was quite funny. And you were lucky, basically, so with a direct flight from Boston to San Diego.
Yeah. No, I was in a fortunate boat there. But that's definitely been becoming more and more rare to hear stories that are that smooth.
I hope it becomes the new normal in a couple of months again.
Yeah, no, likewise, for sure.
Let's talk a bit about fundraising in the United States. I mean, the number one reason why companies from Europe have an eye on the market in the United States is fundraising. And the second reason, of course, is accessing the US market. It's the biggest market in the world still. And Europe has a lot of technology to offer due to, I think, the world's best research organizations and the Horizon Europe program that pours every couple of years hundreds of billions of euros into research. But what we don't have is venture capital post-Series A. Mm-hmm. You closed your seed round, your pre-seed round with NFX, a Silicon Valley-based venture capital firm. And what I'm curious to hear is, in your opinion, what are the three main success factors for companies when they want to find capital in the United States?
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Coaching Conversation 2024. This podcast is 100% dedicated to leadership and leadership within the workplace coaching area. We work with companies throughout the world teaching leaders how to coach their employees. This podcast is dedicated to teaching specific strategies, frameworks, coaching models, and now artificial intelligent strategies to help leaders drive greater teamwork, collaboration, cooperation, greater attitudes, better motivation, coaching career development, just to name a few. I hope you'll check out our podcast.
So I guess, a few things there. So one, this kind of is, I guess, a common thread, but it is networking and getting to know people. I think, the more that you can facilitate getting to know people that can make warm introductions to investors, that is definitely very helpful. Obviously not to discourage cold calls, but it is something that the investors are known for saying. They rarely invest in cold reach outs, that they look for folks who have been introduced to them by someone that they know and someone that they trust. And so the more that you can just chat with folks, become, having connections that can make introductions to investors. This can be connections such as other founders. This can be connections such as, CEOs, if it's later stage funding, that can definitely help. A second facet, and this is, across the board, I think, is just talk to a lot of people and investors. I know that's something that we found, it takes a bit to find the right fit, and an investor company fit is huge. We were, really excited once we realized on our end the synergy with NFX and what we wanted to build and their vision as well in tech bio, as they've called it. And we've really, seen that as a great partnership. So don't be afraid if you've talked to 40 people and you're still looking for traction, just keep that tenacity and keep going, because there are a lot of different flavors of investors and that finding that right fit is huge. And then the last part in that, in that tenacity is just to focus on your strengths and leverage that and don't be modest. I think as scientists, sometimes we like to think the science speaks for itself, which it does, but it still needs someone to blow its own horn. And that's you as the founder. And so that's something that, you know, I think about a lot. I think initially I suffered from that as well, where I was looking at, okay, if the science is great, everyone will see it. But frankly, you know, at the time, you know, I understood it most deeply, and a lot of it to relay that to someone else is to be bold and to say, you know, really what the potential of that is and why it will change the world. And so really, as a scientist, just making sure you're getting out there and being bold in that and speaking with the science on that front.
Excellent points. Let's stay a little bit on the topic relationship building before asking for money. I would like to hear your opinion. Here in Europe, I sometimes learn that people go on the market when they actually are desperately need for money. So one percentage, let's say a major percentage of the companies here start fundraising when they have a runway of 2 to 3 months.
So definitely don't wait that long. I would say, you know, there's you know, different numbers that folks recommend, but leaning towards, you know, 6 months in this market, they say have a 18 months plus even for when you really start fundraising, just because it is a unique market right now. You know, right now we've been making sure we have, you know, roughly 2 years just to have that cushion. So that's something that, yeah, don't waiting until 2 months, you're probably hugely underestimating how long it could take. And that's, that time is not saying that a negative. I mean, that's just a factor of the standards are and what to expect.
When did you start talking with investors with your company?
We started talking with investors early on, actually, when we had the idea, and even pre a lot of, you know, really formal operations. My, you know, co-founder had been in venture, and so he had started to establish connections early on just to get to know, what do investors look for? How do they think? What are, you know, key things to be aware of how to pitch to an investor. And so just in terms of finding some of that out, I think you can very, in a non-committal way, just get to know what they're looking for. You don't even have to say you need money. Just say, hey, I'm thinking of growing a company. We just chat informationally. I think that's something, either at a networking event or the like, it's, you know, investors are very passionate about what they do. They want to get strong pitches. So if they can help to make that happen, I think that's definitely something to look for that type of mentorship. In terms of formal operations, we launched formally actually in January 2020. Interesting time,
yeah,
for sure, as the world changed very quickly thereafter. But you know, that was still an effective getting to know people, getting to know what investors look for. And then we really adapted quickly to learn how to best communicate to that audience what it is that we do.
I'm curious to hear your opinion again on a piece of advice I got. I think it was back in 2008-09. When I was thinking about raising funds, I thought, should I get in touch with investors early on and just talk with them, find out how compelling the story is already, and just hear their opinion? And asked someone and said, wanted to hear their opinion and say, what do you think? Should I go out early before I need the money, or should I just go out on the market, as I said before, when I have to put a deal on the table? And the advice was, you only talk to investors when you want to put a deal on the table. So when you have fleshed out the deal terms and when you want to close the round, never bother investors for just talking. They will put you on a blacklist. What was your experience when talking to investors? Does this blacklist really exist? Did you ever get a negative response when you reached out to investors? Is the way I understood what you said before, that you also talked to investors before you needed the money? You just wanted to hear how compelling your story is and if they can consider investing at a later point. Did you get any negative response from that?
We didn't see anything that we'd been directly aware of that we saw a negative response from. I mean, we had conversations where, you know, there's something where, depending on the investor, if it's just a smaller check size and they're looking to do, you know, oftentimes, and they'll say, you know, chat with us later, and, you know, we would follow up. And that was received you know, that that hadn't been a detriment to us. I mean, I think there is a balance. Obviously, you don't want to be, you want to respect their time. And so I think it's a realm where, you know, how that's approached. I think, you know, if it's chatting at a networking event, that might be an easy segue into to getting to know them and to seeing about just chatting through an idea that you're building. But I think it ends up being very investor dependent. I mean, there are very unique flavors of what they look for and what resonates. So I think a lot of it's also reading the room. And I know that's not a concrete answer, but I think it's a realistic answer of seeing when you get to know an investor, just, you know, if they're willing to chat on that level, or if they say, you know, I've been real booked, you know, come back when you have an idea, then take that at face value. But I think it's worth asking and seeing kind of what their response is to that.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Moving is right up there with death and divorce in the stress Olympics. But fear not. Turn that box of woes into a crate of woes with moving tips in the Life Beyond Boxes podcast with Premium Q Moving. Dive into the world of hassle-free moves, learn tips and tricks to save on cash and your sanity. Say goodbye to those moving meltdowns and hello to the smooth sailings. Or should we say smooth movings? Tune into Life Beyond Boxes with Premium Q Moving on lifebeyondboxes.com or find us on your favorite podcast platform. And with us, unpack the secrets to a stress-free move.
Another question came to my mind that I would like to hear your opinion on that. There are intermediaries on the market. So, for example, you can hire consultants for success fees who get you in touch with investors. Did you ever pursue such route? I have a very strong opinion on that, so I can tell you afterward. I would like to hear your opinion. When you go fundraising, would you hire intermediaries so that they do the work getting you in touch with the investors? Or do you think it's more the work of the founders?
From our perspective, it's been something that we focused on as founders, as opposed to hiring a consultant to directly do that. I mean, I think there are other, you know, other avenues to consider. Can be bringing on strong advisors who can help with introductions. That's one way that maybe a little bit more of a hybrid. They're incentivized to be a part of your team. You see the alignment of they really want to grow the company, hence they're joining as an advisor, and then acknowledging that they have a strong network to help facilitate that. So I can't speak directly to the hiring with a consultant in that exact sense, but other avenues can be bringing on advisors. We really, you know, leveraged our network and spiderwebbed through that to reach folks. Was the strategy that we had used.
No, absolutely.
To date, so. Yeah,
I agree to your approach. So it's also, in my opinion, it's the job of founders. Mm-hmm. And board members. So if a consultant or a person, not a consultant, has a strong network and founders think that this person might be of value in the fundraising process, they should rather bring this person on a board level in the company,
yeah.
Integrate this person in the company as good as it can work with all the environment the person operates in. Exactly. And then go out on the market. I think it's a much stronger pitch than having 20 consultants run around on the market with pitch decks.
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess one other thing to think about is when you chat with investors, even if it's not a fit for their portfolio, to ask if they have, you know, any other, you know, recommendations and inductions that they can make. And that's something that we have found helpful as well, is that then kind of keeps this again kind of, you know, spider webbing of who you know continuing. And investors are, you know, we found them very happy to do that as another avenue. So
When we talk about investors in the United States and someone comes from Europe to United States for fundraising, what are the three do's and don'ts that you recommend when talking with US-based investors?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think the, you know, I guess we can start with the don'ts. I mean, I think one big one is don't think you're the smartest person in the room. I think that's one thing that we found investors really, you know, also observe is how, as a founder, you listen, how do you, you know, integrate and think about taking advice. Remember, at the end of the day, it's still your decision, but it's really respectful. And the investors definitely appreciate your ability to listen and to see how coachable as a team you'd be, as they, if they invest, they're working really closely with you and they're joining your team in many ways. And so that's something that's huge. I talked a bit about the importance of connection. So I think if you're, you know, able to facilitate warm introductions, I think that the don't here is to avoid cold calls, I guess. And the do is to you know, facilitate warm introductions when possible. That's definitely a stronger way to connect with folks. If it's not feasible, you know, that's not to discourage, you know, shooting out an email or LinkedIn connection, but if there's a warm connection, that's definitely very helpful. And I guess as far as a, I don't know if I'm losing count of your exact three versus three, but I'll segue to do is the biggest thing that I've found is to really step back and ask yourself, what is my vision for the future? What am I really building towards? What is the world going to look like when we're successful? Because that's ultimately, you know, what you're selling, that vision and that, you know, existence of the future that folks can be a part of. And so I think make sure to be bold in that and to show them why your future is going to be something they want to be a part of, and look at ways, I guess the second part on that is look at ways that they can help to facilitate that. So this can be through their network. This can be through portfolio companies. This can be through, obviously, you know, capital is a huge part, but investors come with more than capital. And so look at ways when you're chatting with investors that they would be a good fit for that overall.
That sounded wise. I'm curious about the vision for your company. I mean, sometimes when I listen to presentations, there is this part in the presentation where founders talk about an exit point, and it's always a stopping point in my mind, because when I start a company and don't think in terms of exit, I think in terms of building a company, and in the best way, it's a success like Amazon, and we can build it forever like BioNTech or Moderna. What's your vision for your company?
So I guess I'll answer this in two parts. I'll first answer kind of our vision for the future, and then talk about ways that might end up in terms of just the exit or the like. So big picture, our vision is we want a world where we can effectively treat highly complex diseases, and that patients who receive that treatment do effectively respond. One of the big challenges we see in drug discovery today is take oncology. If you're lucky enough to have a cancer where there's a treatment available, there's a next step of you have to be in a category that will actually respond. And then a further step where you hope you don't have resistance as a result of the cancer evolving and overcoming, you know, the treatment itself. So our goal is, with the complexity of our approach of transomics, as we've called it, we can effectively understand the complexities of that disease to drive towards, think of a buzzword, but essentially a true personalized disease medicine in that sense. And so we can go into what that means under the hood, but fundamentally that's the vision. Is you go to the doctor, you're diagnosed, you're prescribed a treatment, and the treatment works. And so that's where we'd like to see going in the future, and what we can build with that. What that means for us as a company is we are a drug developer. So we are developing our own drugs, and we also partner with other pharma companies to support their programs. This allows us to really effectively leverage our technology across a range of different diseases, because our end goal for us as founders is maximize impact for the patient. And so what that means in terms of exit is this, I mean, there are, I think, a lot of different avenues that this could go down depending on the future. We aren't, you know, we're, to your point, we're building it for making our vision of the future come true and making that successful, which will then ultimately lead towards, you know, a highly successful lucrative exit for our investors. And that could be through an acquisition, that can be through selling drugs themselves. I think our goal is to remain a drug developer and to do that through selling assets and the like. You know, we'll see what the future holds. I mean, obviously, if I had a crystal ball, I could tell you more specifically, but our building is to make the most effective company that we can, not to focus on a particular exit in and of itself.
My crystal ball stopped working in March 2020. So
yeah, I don't know if mine was really that affected before March 2020, but I'll still shoot for the moon in its own right. So
I'm really surprised how the world turns out to be in the last 3 years. Let's stay a little bit with your company. What's the story behind the foundation of the company? So is there, what was the reason why you decided you want to found a company with your co-founder? Is there some initial event or some special event that made you going in that direction?
I mean, I'd say there's many things that built up to it. I think there's two fundamental facets. One was for my co-founder and I working on together. We, as early as our kind of getting to know each other during our undergraduate studies, really appreciated our approach to the big picture that we wanted to impact, as well as just working together on projects. We frankly had a lot of fun. We really reinforced, kept a lot of momentum we were working on. We came at things very rationally, which I think was something when we had differing perspectives, we found really effective towards providing an end result that was greater than what each of us would have seen individually. And so that ability for us to really grow ideas and to develop something effectively, we saw as, you know, phenomenal for if we grew a company together down the line. So we kept in touch over time about ideas. And in terms of, you know, the real focus that we've had on healthcare for each of us, this stems from, you know, obviously a lot of, you know, personal experiences with healthcare system essentially failing to deliver, and that experience of what that means individually. When for me, it was when my father was diagnosed with frontal temporal dementia, and the experience of witnessing that was something that I had never really conceptualized what that means until being in the thick of it and really realizing how much, you know, the healthcare system doesn't know. I mean, that was what was so striking to me, is we were told essentially to, you know, they can do imaging studies, but had nothing to help understand or treat the disease further than that. And going home and watching someone fade away was, I don't want someone else to experience that. And that's what drives me to making a difference, is to find treatments to change that for someone else's family's future. And is what, you know, gets me focusing so much of my time on making this a reality, because I know what it's like when the healthcare system doesn't deliver, because we just haven't understood the disease enough. And they're really complicated. That's something that I've found, you know, really humbling in terms of biology itself, is the sheer complexity of the diseases themselves and the need for really comprehensive approaches to tackle them is been focused on for years. And we're finally at a point, hence launching Pepper today, where we can reach that much more effectively. So bringing together new data types and analytics to really look at complex diseases from a new angle to start to find new options for treatments.
I'm sorry to hear about your father's disease.
Thank you. Yeah, I know I'm not alone in this. And so for all the other folks out there, you know, I feel what that's like. And my goal is to make a difference for those in the future. So
that's a great approach from your end. Let's talk a little bit about the problems in drug development that lead to such situations. Mm-hmm. When I stay with the numbers, I think I always tell the story that from 100 drug candidates in the lab, 99 fail. So they don't make it even to translational research. Mm-hmm. And when I look at translational research, so 9 out of 10 candidates fail. And when I go further down the road in clinical development, we have the same picture, 9 out of 10 fail. I would like to hear your perspective with your experience. What are the big problems in drug development that need to be solved to understand diseases better and to help more people?
That's a fundamental question that we talk about a lot is, you know, and when we built Pepper, what we really looked at was what are researchers really, you know, chiming in on what's the biggest problems. And we really found three, we call pillars, that we think about that we at Pepper overcome. So the first is one of the big challenges is looking at global information. So if you think about traditionally, a lot of times folks even talk about, they might have a favorite pathway that they look at, but they have a really narrow lens of what defines a a disease itself. And historically, this made sense just given the data we had access to, so we see why we progressed there. But this focus on really narrow pathways is part of what drives the problem you outlined. So let's say we look at a pathway to find a disease, but miss really critical feedback mechanisms that are outside of that canonical pathway. So at many stages in that development, which can be early on, which can be later in the clinic, there can be pathways of feedback that ultimately show, say, toxicities that are detrimental. And you see, again, those numbers come again and again of things not working. And that's one of the key reasons why is folks miss early on looking at fundamentally critical components to understand that disease and how to best treat the disease. A second facet that we found is looking at essentially the right type of information. So we've gotten much better over the last 20 years. We've been phenomenal at having genomics data. That's only part of the picture. Biology is a highly complex multi-step process that goes from genomics to transcriptomics to proteomics to then modified proteins. And it's those modified proteins that are the end molecular players. And so really what we want is the ability to capture this entire scope of that multi-step process as opposed to focusing on very early stages of it. So that's a key part that we overcome by bringing functional information. So by having this functional context, we can really see a refined ability to understand what proteins are doing in a disease and how to then best intervene to correct that, to treat the disease. And so this really, again, will drive that, improving our ability to select targets and to make informed decisions at each step in that drug discovery process. So those numbers that you listed can be improved. And then lastly is a realm of look of how we look at these data layers. And so this third pillar that we talk about a lot is what we do at Pepper is drive towards a more causal understanding of the interplay between these data layers. That's highly complex in the sense of, again, how, like, if you have a transcript that's increased, you may not see the same increase in protein. So we need to make sure we look at understanding how these interplay and what their relationships are to best identify the true disease drivers that aren't just a, you know, artifact of correlation, that are more driving at the true biology.
That's a very interesting point. I read an article recently, I think it was one or 2 weeks ago, with the bold statement that 90% of all scientists who ever lived on this planet are still alive today. So So 90% of all scientists that ever lived on this planet are alive today. When you look at the graph of the PhDs, you see an exponential increase in the last 20 years. So there is a lot of science going on these days. And I always thought, how can you make sense of the tremendous amount of data that's produced globally? What's your solution to that problem? I mean, PhDs produce a lot of papers, a lot of articles, a lot of lab-based research data. Then we move it into companies. We get more data on top of that. And everything is stored somewhere in PDF files, I guess. And the organization sometimes feels to me that we are still stuck back in the 80s, 90s in databases. Google search is great, but I'm not so confident that Google search or also the search engines in the scientific world are that far advanced. I think not much changed in the last 20 years. What new solutions do you bring to the market when it comes to data?
So our solutions in terms of what we're bringing that's unique is one, just how we, you know, how we look at the data itself in the realm of how we're actually interpreting the data in an effective way to understand, I guess it's twofold. So one is the data that we collect itself. So this is those data layers I'd mentioned of genomics, transcriptomics, proteomics, phosphoproteomics. So we're comprehensive in the data that we bring. But secondly, and this probably a bit more to your point of just data that's out there, how we leverage that is we also bring in what we call reference data. And so, especially in biology, it's really complex and there's been a wealth of information that folks have established to date. And so we do, you know, we have a unique approach to bring in that reference information that consists of, you know, protein interactions. So established relationships between proteins and substrates, for example. we bring in that information in our own unique way that actually allows us to better leverage that data. We actually expand upon that by leveraging across different experimental systems in a way that's very robust. So we still have abilities to have experimentally specific data. So we're not making spurious conclusions, but we can expand upon what's there and better leverage that huge wealth of information that keeps growing. Now, I think your question brings up an even larger, more complex problem of just, okay, if we have all this information, even beyond, say, the reference data that we look, just data from biology and other sciences, you know, I think that's a larger question that we'll see changes to over time of how we best search and access information and how we store it. I think it's exciting to see where we've come. Like you mentioned, in terms of search in general has been huge. But I think that's, it's also its own unique space of information prioritization and storage that's then commonly available. But I think that's a whole nother realm. We could probably have a whole nother podcast that focused on that because it's a exciting space and definitely a challenging space in its own right.
I saw the look on your face when I mentioned the statement before, and I have pulled out the article while you were speaking. Can show you here. It's a Future of Life Institute and the state. 90% of all the scientists that ever lived are alive today. And it's very interesting to read. It's a very short article, but when you look at the worldwide PhDs granted annually, just I think it's the last 20 years that there is an exponential increase. So, and I think it will continue. I mean, when you look at the United States, there is a lot of funding for universities. Yeah. When you look at Europe, United Kingdom, we have a lot of funding available. And every year read that the governments want to add more public funding to that. And I believe, I mean, China wants to become the global innovation leader. So there's a statement mm-hmm. that they have put out in 2017, and they also pour a lot of capital into research. Yeah. So I think the data production will go up exponentially.
No, it's definitely a really astute observation about the data that means itself. And I think it's, you know, that's one thing that we're excited about with our own company is the ability to internally start to establish our own very robust, clear, and applicable to the problems that we're solving data infrastructure. I think that's something in talking with folks at other companies, when you have a really large company, that's it's a lot of momentum to make a change. And so that's something I guess just personally I find really exciting about what we're building in startups themselves is we're very adept, we're very small, we're very, you know, agile in being able to respond to information in a way that just is logistically much more challenging in a larger company. So I guess that's just a plug for all the folks out there who are excited about joining a startup. I think that's one of the strong suits is just speed to adapting and to growing in its own right.
That's true. Let's talk a little bit about your team. What makes your team excellent?
What makes our team excellent? Many things. But I mean, I guess the things that highlight, we are a very passionate team, a very driven team. That's something that when, you know, for the partners that we work with, both on our core team, as well as advisors and investors, that we look for their drive towards achieving, you know, the vision that we're building towards. Second would be a team that's very diverse. So we have folks from a range of different backgrounds. We have biologists, we have a theoretical physicist, we have you know, folks experience more deeply on the business background and banking. So we really have a breadth of perspectives, which is something that I've found in our team. And I think across the board is key to really solving challenging problems because, you know, within an individual field, I think just by nature of groupthink, there can often be blinders that come to play. And so we think very carefully about how we've been growing the team to overcome that by bringing in folks who say haven't been embedded deeply in the field for, you know, decades where that may happen. And just by nature of experience and exposure. And then a last facet, I mean, it's something that we've seen across the board of just the ability to adapt to things quickly. That's something that, you know, for folks joining a startup, that is critical because There's, you know, a lot of responding to what the needs are at the time, of seeing, you know, where the technology fits best and being able to critically think through that and really accomplish the overarching goal in the most effective way possible. We talk a lot about goals in terms of our company, that making sure that we're focused on reaching an endpoint that's clear and that our actions are most attuned to reaching that. And we've found, you know, our core team to date has been phenomenal at doing so. And we're grateful for just the experiences we've had with them so far, and excited to bring more folks on. We're actually hiring right now, both kind of for the broader team in R&D, as well as within building out experience within the development side. And so if folks are interested, that is something we're actively recruiting for. And if you're excited to build out the World's Nest Transomics platform and be a part of that core platform development, come talk to me. Would love to hear your thoughts and interest there.
That's a great message, because the usual message currently on the market is we are laying off people and you go the other direction and we're hiring.
Well, we've been very, very particular on we're thinking very strategically amidst the current market, but we have big goals that we're accomplishing and we are focusing on reaching those. And some of that is right now is building out the team. So if folks are interested, definitely excited to chat. So
I'm curious. You closed the pre-seed round. And yes. What is the big goal that you would like to achieve with your team with the pre-seed capital?
So we're actually, our next immediate milestone that we're building towards is to identify a drug candidate that can reach the clinic quickly. That's one of the things that we talk about a lot for a validation. And so we're working on some early discovery studies to support that, while also partnering with pharma in parallel. Since we're building out the platform, we can use that internally as well as partnering with pharma. And so by establishing that candidate that can quickly reach the clinic, as well as through partnership validations, we really demonstrate our ability to successfully apply our technology. This builds upon existing validation that we have to date from work that's been carried out in oncology systems, where we've effectively showed stratifying unique tissue and mutation types within cancers. We've also demonstrated in inflammatory diseases to date, where we have effectively identified a novel target. And then lastly, we've also already achieved a partnership with pharma where we actually broadened their understanding of a drug's mechanism of action. And so that was a kind of a really exciting opportunity to bring value to the pharma space to date already.
I'm curious, in your operations, the audience of the podcast is 50% in Europe and 40% in the United States. And you said that you're hiring. Do you have a global focus in your hiring strategy, or would you prefer that people move to Boston, Cambridge?
We are, for our core team, we are looking for folks to preferably be local, in part just we're a small company. And that's a huge part for us of establishing a strong culture. We think that, you know, being able to be in the same place, being able to get to know each other, especially at this size, is really essential. And that's just been, again, a strategic facet of we want to know that we're effectively growing Pepper's identity in that sense. But we are looking for folks globally. I mean, that's something, if there's a fit, we do support visas. Obviously, there's always timing facets that come into play with that to discuss. But very open to chatting with folks globally and seeing if there's a fit. So
how difficult is this to get the work permission in the United States at this point?
It really depends on country. And I'll admit that's my depth on that is really case by case. So I don't want to speak for across the board, but it's something that we do look to bring in folks. You know, first we look by fit and then can sort out the details supporting that. So
when is your next fundraising round planned?
So we are actively raising at this point. So if investors are excited to chat about what we're doing and to be a part of building the world's first transomics platform to treat the untreatable, very excited to talk. We are actively working on closing that raise. So very happy to connect.
May I ask how much money you are looking for currently?
We aren't disclosing numbers just over podcasts and interviews, but we're happy to chat with folks and talk more on details of the terms. So,
and what is your preferred investor? So what would be your perfect investor at this point in time, if you could select?
Yeah. So broad strokes, we're looking for an investor who is as passionate about changing the future of drug discovery as we are. And also doing that through a repeatable process, through a platform technology that can discover novel drugs. So that's something that we've been thrilled about within working with NFX, and are thrilled to meet new investors that are focusing towards that vision.
That's a great interview. Samantha, I could continue asking questions, but I had to look at the time, and we are here in Vienna. It's 6:40, so we are 10 minutes over time already. And I know that you have a lot of work to do. Is there anything in the podcast that I missed and that you would like to add at the end?
I guess the only resounding kind of closing note that I'd give is the excitement for the future that's to come, in that we've seen over time this bringing of new data and information through genomics, through transcriptomics of the last 10, 20 years. And I am ecstatic to be at a time where it's inevitable that we'll see bringing new technologies to bear of larger data sets and data collection in biology. I think it's a phenomenal time to be in the field, and excited to be leading the charge in bringing functional data such as fossil proteomics to play to really reach that goal of treating the untreatable. So excited to share the story today. Thanks too for a great chat. Really loved our conversation.
That's awesome. I have one final question that I would like to ask. My community, there are a lot of scientists who think about founding a company, and coming up with a vision often is, I think every scientist has some sort of vision that keeps them going. Yeah. But when it comes to founding a company, I realized that finding the first step towards founding a company sometimes is tricky for some people. What is your advice when someone says, I would like to found a company, but I don't know what I should do first? What is your advice to this type of personalities?
Yeah, so I think, across the board, I would seek a mentor who's been an entrepreneur. I think there's a lot of, insights that can be gleaned from someone who's walked through that door before. They can also be a phenomenal sounding board as you're going through the process of, finding investors, of, finding hires. I think that type of sounding board, mentor, and resources also just as a individual, I think really helpful to be able to pick up the phone and call someone and say, I need help on this. What do I do? And at least talk with someone who's been through it before, who either has an answer or may know someone who has an answer. So I think as much as you can find a mentor, that is the biggest piece of advice that I would give.
That's great advice. Samantha, thank you very much for this amazing conversation. I enjoyed Likewise. It from the first minute to the last, and I would love to keep going, but that time is scarce. Let's have an update when you close your next funding round. I'm curious to learn what changed then in your company.
Perfect. Sounds excellent. Looking forward to it. Thank you so much for the conversation.
Thank you for being part of the show. Have a great day.
You too.
Bye-bye. Did you like the episode? Then please, please, please leave a 5-star review on Spotify and Apple, and make sure that you like, comment, and share the YouTube episode. It helps that the algorithm delivers the episode to people who also benefit from it the same way than you did. Have a great day.